Welcome to the 36th episode of the Reckless Dice Podcast, where we discuss Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition. Joining tonight's show, we have Layla Fridge Gargoyle Miranova.
Hey guys.
And special guest, Jay Americal Hafner.
Howdy.
And I am Jesse, your face Burke. Really, did we change that already? I'm like the guy who reads off the teleprompter, and even though I knew that was wrong, I couldn't stop from saying it.
Well, that's exactly why I put it there. I was waiting to see if you just read it straight through or if you'd pause for a second and be like, wait a minute.
No, I'm
that's not my alter ego.
That's like that movie, Anchorman, uh-huh. Where he's reading the teleprompter and they're putting all sorts of horrible stuff and he can't not read it.
Yeah, it's a funny movie.
So how's everybody doing tonight?
It's an awesome night. I was hoping we'd have some sound effects in the background for some of this stuff. We might have to do that for one of these upcoming episodes.
You can give us some sound effects.
Where are your monkeys?
The monkey. We'll find some.
There haven't been a lot of news. I mean, Fantasy Flight has been generally quiet for the past, I think we could probably call it, 2 months or so, with the last print-on-demand supplement being the last thing that we've heard, and we're all kind of anxiously awaiting news on it's been so long I've forgotten what it's called. The Enemy Within?
That's the one.
Yeah. And so, you know, we've been pretty much creating our own news at this point and having some fun. This past week, we ran a live session called The Raven as part of the Old World League, and Daniel Wise wrote that adventure, and we put up a live recording of that. That was good fun. Layla and I and Jordan got a chance to create some custom characters for that and pretty much just go a little bit crazy and have some fun with it.
Mm-hmm.
You played a halfling.
I did.
I got to play my ogre.
You did.
I played that ogre.
You loved that ogre.
You played it pretty hard. I could hear the voice on that one.
Yeah. It's a really hard to maintain, like, a voice for that long.
Because you did a voice for yours.
I did, and halfway through I was annoyed with it. So
I was wondering why that changed.
Okay.
Was that what happened? I didn't even realize it.
Well, no, part of it is I started using the voice only when he was talking in character, but when I was thinking or narrating what he was doing, I was using my own voice for that. So I don't know. I got mixed around for a while, and I got tired of it. So I applaud you for sticking with the voice.
I think it had to happen for Stone Paunch because he had so little to say. So when he said anything, it had to have substance to it.
Yeah. You
know, that was the first time I'd ever played a character with an accent as a PC. I thought it was a lot of fun, actually.
The accent was fitting, and it's probably one of those things we could talk about here, is when it comes to the ogres, a lot of people just play them as the big dumb fighter, just kind of dopey accent, and I thought you played it up pretty well, having something a little burly, but it wasn't, he didn't come across as just dumb.
I was trying for something like a big Russian meathead.
You got it.
You did, yeah.
How'd you imitate that so well?
I have a well practiced Russian accent. But I mean, have you ever, Jay, played a character that, or maybe look back up for a second. Do you often give your characters unique voices as an NPC or as a PC?
I always do, and what I try to work on more is a lot of the voices start to sound the same. So I try and work with phraseology. You try and have a catchphrase or some type of thing that's going to come across their theme, really.
Oh, you mean like, hey, Hodge, you know, if I have not told you this before, you're very intelligent for halfling.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that type of stuff, you know.
I decided that was going to be something that Stone Paunch would say several times as if he'd forgotten he'd already told it to them the hour before.
And you stuck to that.
I don't know if it came across well, but I mean, like, in my head, that's hysterical.
It was, yeah. I thought that it was pretty good overall, your portrayal of him.
So Jay, you were saying that you've done it with the phraseology, which is, I think, really interesting. Can you talk a little more about that?
Well, we recently played this is a Pathfinder game, but we played goblins, I guess, in one of these scenarios. And so I took my mini cassette recorder, and I would record a whatever the heck I was going to say. And then I just always end it with a ha-ha or some type of giggling laugh, maniacal or something gobble-like. And then I'd play it back, and I would play it to the group and fast-forward, so it sounded high-pitched. And I didn't even have to change my voice for that one. But that was good fun.
Interesting. So the Raven Adventure, that's available to listen. That again is kind of part of the Old World League, which is an online group where you can have these great one-off adventures all around the world that don't necessarily have to interlink together. So they're great for one-offs or very short campaigns, or if you want to try adventures out in like Lustria or Naggaroth or really anywhere you want to go. This is a great way to facilitate that without having to get your party out there. You are a mercenary company, and you do crazy things.
They get to try out a lot of different GMs. You get to see different GM styles. I mean, different player styles. It kind of sharpens your skills for your home games. Or a lot of guys use this as their game too.
Yeah, I mean, if there's one bit of advice I could give to anybody as a player or as a GM, is expose yourself to as many GMs as possible, because everybody's play styles, even players as well, but GMs in particular, because everybody's style is different, and you will find things you enjoy from different. You'll take little bits and pieces of what you like from everybody and concoct some style that works for you. So we're also gearing up next Wednesday to begin a new adventure, The Lure of Power, which is the adventure in the Slaaneshi supplement. And Chris Wagner, who GM'd the Horrid Hugeldahl game, will be GMing this game as well. So, Baerdan, Thorin, Helga, and Conrad will be returning for that adventure. And Helga, you're plus one bear.
I am plus one bear.
Which will be an interesting thing to kind of figure out how that's going to actually incorporate itself into real-world games now.
Maneuvering that bear is going to be really interesting, because I imagine it's going to take...
Now, Jay, do you know what we're talking about here?
I was going to ask you about that. Go ahead.
You don't know about my bear?
Go ahead.
So, in the last adventure, I picked up a bear.
You freed it from a circus.
I did. I freed it from a Kislevian circus in the dead of night. I had some help from my friendly dwarfin friends, and I stole away with a bear.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah. So now essentially I have to...
You've been training
We've been training it, so it's at least following us and not hurting any of us. But now there's going to be the challenge of essentially making it...
What do you do with a bear now that you have a bear?
Yeah.
What happens when you go to an inn and you have to stable it?
Exactly.
Does it eat the horses, or does it, what do you feed it every day? And
yeah.
But it brings up an interesting mechanical question that I had for you, Jay, on how you might handle this. So you've got a character who's from Kislev, and she's got a bear. Now, people riding bears is in the Warhammer lore already, so in theory this could even double as a mount. But it could also be, it can participate in combat, it's big, it's got interesting story elements. How would you, just off the cuff, handle, rules-wise, something that you would add to a character to the scale of a bear?
Libra Fanatica 7, Sunitet, from Poland, wrote the pets rules for that stuff.
And does that cover things of that size?
Absolutely, it's what he designed it for. Since we didn't have a Kislevian, what do they call them? Second edition bear trainers, whatever. One of the second edition guys will correct me, but that's what we had before. So we wrote that specifically for this, and then we figured anything else works. And then I get to just train it up to the level of JoJo the Dancing Bear from the Last Night on Earth game, and you'll have an extra PC in a group.
I was wondering if you almost treat it like another character or a half character, something that you can control but also has its own turn and initiative, or at what point do you kind of begin to unbalance a character even though balance isn't really that much of an issue, I feel.
The rule is just as long as you don't treat it like an automaton, like you're at one end of the building and the bear couldn't hear you at the other end of the building, and suddenly the player is like, oh, well, my bear's going to go fetch all these things and do all these things. You know, you just got to kind of have the bear be in the bear sometimes when they're not in contact with their boss, or sometimes when they are in contact with their boss.
I mean, ultimately, how I'd like to treat it is, you know, like, say, for instance, in an attack mode where we're all fighting, I would like Helga to have her own turn for her to take an action. I would like the bear to have a separate turn so that I don't have to give up my turn for the bear. And I don't really think that's cheating, because there's a lot of animal handling that goes into his turn. So it's not necessarily that he'll be successful in a maneuver or, like, grant me as a character any protection or, you know, unfair advantage if he gets his own turn. That's what I really don't understand about, like, even with the vicious dog that is, you know, like a pet that you can have, I don't understand why his turn has to act as your character's turn.
Well, in your case, you just sick the bear on something, and that runs. I mean, you'd take, what, a maneuver or an action to, say, you know, attack him, and the bear's not going to just stop every turn and look at you.
Right.
If it's on somebody, it's going to maul him to death, I suppose. Yeah. And,
but, like, maybe we work as a team.
There's an interesting way that maybe this is what you just said, or maybe this inspired it to me, but the rule... So you're standing there and you're about to engage into combat. You're standing next to your bear. And your problem, Layla, is that you don't want to sacrifice your attack for your bear to attack.
Right.
But maybe in that initiating combat phase where you're like, okay, bear, attack that guy. You've given your bear a command, and from that point forward, the bear will carry out that command until it's complete.
Right. And then you
use your action for instigating the command, sacrificing your turn, your first turn.
But
then the bear continues to attack on its own. Then you're free to go attack while your bear does its thing until the bear finishes the combat or finishes eating or doing whatever a bear would do in that scenario.
That makes sense to me.
That makes sense to all animals in that regard, unless it's something special or you want to change the command, at which point you would do another action.
Because that's largely why I never allow Rob to go into battle, because...
Rob's not as effective as you are,
why bother? Yeah. Exactly, yeah. But, you know, if I've got a bear who can now do some damage, why can't he go and then I go, like, at the same time? We could work as a team.
I'm liking this. We've added a chapter of House Rules.
There you go.
Jay has a book of House Rules that are... How big?
Yeah, but it's only, like, a page thick. Again, joke.
Yeah, actually, tell us a little bit about your house rules, because you offer those up for download, don't you?
Yeah, it's everybody, you know, it's the thing about house rules. We put them up there so people, you know, think about some of those concepts and stuff. And I originally wrote it to placate some of the people who were griping about the fact that there weren't enough careers, or there weren't enough, you know, we didn't have international bases like Kislevites and stuff. And so halflings, I wrote up those halfling rules right off the bat. And
mm-hmm.
like,
I
oh,
that.
Well, what can you say? I don't have halflings? Well, you do now. And, you know, I think that just helped move the game along, get people back to what really counted, what was playing, and not worrying about, you know, whether or not the game was complete at the incept. But, I've always liked to keep my rules concise, but, you know, relevant to my playstyle. I tend to play a fast game.
I was going to say, to that effect, a lot of your house rules were centered around eliminating unnecessary components to keep it, you know, streamlined.
Correct.
I think that was one of the things I appreciated the most about them. Other news, we just finished recording episodes 9 and 10 of Buried But Not Forgotten with Michael Wilson. Those will be coming up in the coming week. And two other bits of news.
Wait on this. I want this Buried But Not Forgotten. I haven't sat through and listened to all these episodes. Can you give us a quick synopsis of what's happened so far?
So Buried But Not Forgotten is a custom-written adventure by Michael Wilson. And we play, Layla and I both play in that game along with three other people. And the game is, a sandbox adventure game that has been written in a small region, and there everybody has had kind of provided a bunch of plot seeds at the beginning to Michael, who then wrote a bunch of adventure seeds and threads throughout the region, and we are allowed to just explore at our as we please, and he tailors the adventure to where we go at any given point. And it's my understanding he runs a calendar of events where certain things will happen at different points throughout our adventure, you know, whether we're there or not. And that has been a very interesting game, particularly the last few sessions that were released had some of the best inter-party conflict that we had done to date that was really, really exciting and, you know, almost had the party almost to a degree attacking each other to resolve some of the story elements. I think we got a lot of positive feedback on those. Those have been very well listened to.
Mm-hmm.
So Jay, tell us about the scenario contest that you're putting together.
All right. So here's the deal. We had the scenario contest for the last several years. Black Industries and other groups have put stuff on, and then Fantasy Flight put on the first year of it. And I don't believe they got a really great turnout. We got some good scenarios out of it. Jason Bateman's scenario was awesome. There's a couple others that came out, but they only posted like three. Or whoever won, and then the two runners-up. And I thought, you know, if there were 15 scenarios submitted, it sure would be nice to see all those things, because then we could play them. If you look at second edition, there's a couple of hundred scenarios out there that fans have written. They have a very vibrant community that writes stuff for that stuff. And then we wanted to be able to carry that over for third edition. So my friend Sumit Sarkar and I started harassing in Fantasy Flight a little bit about it. And they sent Sumit a box full of Daylight Chilling Short and Journey to Blackfire Pass and some other stuff. And we thought, you know, we thought initially we would just, you know, hand these out to people at conventions. And we thought, no, let's get the scenario contest started again. So we have this box of goodies. We're going to give a copy of Daylight Chilling Short out to anybody that, you know, writes the bare minimums, at least for the scenario contest.
So this is a printed copy of it?
Yeah, it's the printed copies. I took a picture and posted them on that thread, too, of all that stuff. I mean, it's just a stack of it. I mean, they sent us like 80 copies of Daily Chilling Short. I don't know if they were trying to get rid of them or if they were just trying to placate us from giving them so much noise. But the goal on this was to get a scenario contest started. I talked to one of the other guys in the forum, and he was like, well, why don't we just write regular scenarios? And the point is we have so many scenarios out there for second edition that are downloadable, and that stuff's really easy to convert, that we didn't want just another scenario. We wanted the one thing missing from this game is that it's not played at conventions all that much. And so a lot of people have said that it sure would be nice if we had something like that. So the discussion went around, well, how best to do it, and we're basically just letting the writers come up with the ingenuity. I put down some basic guidelines just for presentation's sake, for, you know, the sake of GMs running these games. And our goal is to, you know, put out some stuff this year and probably do it again next year.
So what are some of the basic guidelines that we're looking at here?
Well, we had a word count minimum. We wanted at least we didn't want a one-pager. One-pagers are great and stuff, but they don't really work for conventions. We need stuff that's actually a bit more fleshed out. So I don't have the exact details in front of me, but I think we put like, you know, 4,000, 10,000 words or something like that, some pages, and pre-generated characters. You can either mm-hmm. write new ones, which people like to do, or, you know, use the ones that are in Liber Fanatica 7 or whatever. And then the other, you know, things that we thought long and hard about our layouts on this stuff. We wanted, you know, standardized stat blocks and, you know, not a bunch of new rules that guys got to look up when they're running, you know, 6 to 9 games at a convention. And then it's also, you know, it's got to be playable for a regular group. The nice thing about these is they're designed to run each round, if you're on a multi-round or a single round, runs in about 3.5 to 4 hours, which works great for a Tuesday, Thursday night gaming group to play that type of stuff. And we also wanted it to be newbie friendly, because teaching people this game, we kind of forget we've been playing long enough, but there's a lot of things to learn in this game. It's not just, you know, roll a die and apply some damage. You know, there's so many other components to this game that need to be applied, and it's what makes it fun, but it's also what makes it difficult to teach. So I think if we can help the GMs out a bit out there, it helps us grow this hobby. And if we grow the hobby, then theoretically Fantasy Flight will continue to support the game and follow up with more stuff.
So if somebody wanted to participate in this, where do they go?
The thread is on the Fantasy Flight Games forum there.
Well, we'll make sure and put that in the show notes.
Yep.
And if they do they just say they want to sign up there?
Yep. You basically say, hey, I'm interested. And we've seen a lot of people post saying that, you know, they don't really know where to start. And it's not hard. I mean, all of us.
Lucky
GMs,
for them, our main topic today is writing your own adventures.
How convenient.
With the king of writing adventures, Jay Hafner.
So we'll get to. I guess we'll talk about that in a minute. But yeah, that's the point of it. And it's for newbies to experienced writers. We're going to give some prizes out to everybody who contributes, and then we're going to pick our top couple and give them some Journey to Blackheart Pass, and I'm going to sponsor some extra dice or something, maybe a gift card or something, and we'll get that out to our top. And we're getting people, you know, who want to write from around the world, which makes it even more fun.
Excellent. So are we just based on that last comment there, are we supporting multiple languages, or how are we handling that?
We want it in English. Obviously, translation is something that's easier for a lot of these other guys than it is for us. But, if we get stuff that's in a foreign language, I'm more than happy to help translate that stuff.
Cool.
But we're looking for, we want to revitalize the writing community for Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay.
Excellent. And our last bit of news for this episode is that over the last week, Liber Fanatica 9 Part 1 went live. And Jay, you've been pretty intimately involved with Liber Fanatica for at least the past few releases, right?
Yeah, I started with issue number 7, and
you were the lead on that one, is that right?
Yep. And again, I just, I'm not the greatest writer, but I got a lot of pent-up energy on wanting to write stuff. And, we found that if somebody just steps up and, volunteers to do some of this stuff, I mean, once you start writing, it's almost kind of addictive because you get so many ideas and you're like, wow, I can put this stuff out. And so the Ordo Fanatica is the name of the group that puts our stuff together, and we just invite writers in and write stuff up. But this latest issue is fantastic. Jussi Alahuar, I can't even pronounce his last name. He goes by Undermount, is our artist on this stuff, and he's done.
He was the artist on. He was the designer on the last one as well.
He did a
fantastic job on that one as well.
Yeah.
This one's beautiful. Equally, he may have even learned a few things from the last one, because this one I think is much more refined and very attractive.
Yeah, it's just amazing work that he does. And then our writers, we've got in part one that was released, we have a lot of stuff that's coming out. Part one's got the Imperial Gazetteers, and it's kind of a rehash of some earlier stuff. Ralph Seller wanted to rewrite some of the trade and commerce stuff, and he did a good job, but he wanted to kind of expand and continue from Liber Fanatica 8. And that, a lot of that stuff, dates back to way back in first edition when they had it for the Marienburg official supplement that came back out way in first edition. And now we've got great third edition rules for that type of stuff. So it gives our peddlers and merchant characters something to do beyond the basics. And then Ray Russell wrote a great article on Chaos at the Table, dealing with problematic players and stuff. And she wrote a good one for me back in Liber Fanatica 7 on just generally playing non-combatant characters to the hilt, I guess. And then there's a nice thick GM section on Mordheim. That one has been really popular so far.
Yeah, that's actually where I skipped straight to and began reading that, because Mordheim's one of my favorite tabletop games that Games Workshop released, and I was really interested to see. I always thought that'd be a great element for fantasy roleplay, and I'm really glad that someone was touching on that.
Right, just to see somebody step back into that realm and resurrect some of those old, feelings and images that we all had back when we played the Mordheim game, and now it's back on board. And then after that, we got a couple of new adventures, a couple of one sheets. another short adventure, and then part two of Laurie's Masters of Shadow campaign, and you know, more good works there. And then again, like always, a big stack of cards and handouts that Jesse put together. And just again, just another fantastic issue. I think people that don't really know what Libra Fanatica is, when they first download this stuff, they're like, wow, the sheer amount of content that comes out, you know, it's just amazing.
That's certainly true. The amount of content that's in these things and the production value are so high that it's just a pleasure to look at.
Well, I think Jesse's got it in his mind. He wants to do a better job than Fantasy Flight. If he could put this stuff in box sets, he'd do it.
You know, actually, I printed out issue 8 not too long ago, and it was expensive to print, but it, you know, it was really. I mean, I think it's worth it. I'd love to see some way to buy these some at a later date or some other way to obtain them in a paper form.
Yeah, they're pretty hefty tomes. I actually haven't printed out much except for just the components that I use. I just print out the parts that I need. And when I bring new players to my table, I have them, you know, they don't know how to start the game. They don't know how to make a character. They may not have the books. I just tell them to go to Libra Fanatica 7 and pick one of the pre-gens out of there, and they're set to go. And that's there's all those characters are complete. And for issue 10, I wrote the remaining basic characters up. I think doing the advanced characters would take a bit more work, and we haven't really started thinking about that. We're hoping to get that out for issue number 10 as well. And yeah, it's pretty amazing stuff. I was only a proofreader on this one. Initially, I just kind of was just there as a motivating factor to get our episodes or get our issue started again and get everybody back on top of it. And this time, it was a group of guys that got together on it. And you'll have to look up their names in the front of the book, and they worked their tails off on getting this thing out. So kudos to them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm just thrilled with this one. It's great. I'm still in the middle of reading it, but I'm thoroughly enjoying it. Well, let's take a quick break, and when we get back, I want to touch in on how to write your own adventures. And we're back. So we're going to be talking about writing your own adventures, particularly pertinent to this episode since the scenario contest is gearing up. You know, maybe some of you do need help getting started. I, for one, have never written an adventure, but I have played a couple custom-written adventures. Jay, you've written a couple yourself. Layla, you're a writer. I can write the alphabet and combine them into words.
That's right.
I don't tell stories with them, nor do I really know how. I think that part is really just lost on me.
You know, but how verbally it might not translate
verbally
into writing.
But I'm curious, and I would like to participate, though I don't think I really have the ability. But you know, Jay, where does one start?
Well,
because this is specifically for writing an adventure, not a story. So I imagine there's elements that need to be taken into account from a gameplay perspective and a rules perspective. And you're writing a story for a role-playing game. So I imagine you have to kind of provide the plot tree.
Right. Well, it's just like anything else. I mean, you got to have, you know, why in the heck you're writing it. If you're writing for a scenario contest, for a convention scenario, that's one thing. If you're writing it for your group, that's another. You know, a lot of GMs, you know, they prefer to write all their own stuff. They make it all up from scratch. And if they give themselves just a little bit extra time ahead of time, all their scenarios don't start sounding the same after a while if they're playing a sandbox world. Basically, the thing that you're starting on is you put your characters in mind first. I mean, yes, you can write stuff where, you know, the big bad evil guy or the big evil, you know, organization is revolving around the PCs. That's fine too. But just you find your starting point, you find that little bit of motivation that catches your eye. For me, I like to read those adventure hooks or little tidbits of information that, you know, you're reading some scenario and they have like a little red herring or something that doesn't turn into anything, but you're like, wow, that would make for a really good scenario. Those are the little where to starts. And then, I mean, next, it's just the basics of writing. You start with a skeletal outline of, you know, where do I want this to go? And you don't have to have it go that way when you write. You just start filling in the details, and if it doesn't work, you go a different direction, and then just start putting it through. The easiest way to do it is to write yourself a linear outline of steps 1 through 10. Here's where they start. They get hired at an inn, and they have a weird encounter. They do some investigation. They have a combat, which leads them to another red herring or to the real thing, and then they fight the big, bad, evil guy in the end. I mean, it's that simple. Hollywood does it every day. It's not that hard. You know, you ever watch one of those movies where you're like, I could have written that? You know, Conan, for instance. But, you know, you take those movies.
Wait, are you saying Conan was not a literary masterpiece?
But then don't you sit through some of that stuff and you're just like, yeah. Oh my God, my gaming group is smarter than this. You know? Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, I find myself sometimes watching a movie and thinking, God, that would make a really good adventure. And I just don't really know how to, without just feeling like I'm ripping off the movie, write something that would, you know, kind of come together in that fashion. I mean, what kind of components do you have to include to make it a usable adventure? I've never really taken the effort to dissect how an adventure's written to understand what it needs to be workable for someone else to use it.
Your basic, for somebody else to take care of something like this, so say, for example, I'll just focus on the kind of like writing a scenario for a convention, for instance. So you're writing a scenario for another GM. The first thing you should always remember is GMs are smart, and they will fill in the blanks. You don't need to overwrite a scenario. People feel like they need to write a novel. You don't need to write a novel. That's why these one-sheet adventures work pretty well in most situations, is GMs get inspired and they're like, they can fill in the blanks. They can do that. But you still have to have a structure of how to get from point A to point B to point C. And then with role-playing games, you're throwing in the elements of your NPCs, which are incredibly important. Never underestimate how important it is to have a colorful, memorable NPC. People will have millions of encounters in their lives and millions of combats and fight a gazillion Skaven, if they existed, that type of stuff. And they'll forget about those, but they will always remember your weirdo NPCs that popped up in the middle of the adventure. And love them or hate them, those are going to be the kind of some of the things that they're going to remember. And then it always helps to have that, just that overarching theme. So when you write an adventure, you put your skeletal outline down, steps 1 through 10, I usually say, and just start filling in your blanks. You put in, if you're going to use some read aloud text, you put that in there, your GM's text. Have a very easy to read stat block or reference, you know, your creature compendium or whatever you're going to reference for that stuff. If you're writing for somebody else, if you've got some new element that needs to be in there, you don't need to write an entirely new section on poison, for instance. You can do like they did in, Eye for an Eye, whichever scenario it was that has the spoiler alert, has one of those little poisons in there. Mm-hmm, and just a quick detail on how to use that stuff, and then just keep going. A lot of GMs make the mistake of starting with big, huge stat blocks and monsters and stuff. Don't do that. Basically, just say if you're using a Femir, for instance, you just reference Femir. You can always put in the details later, but don't stop your writing creativity to write up stat blocks or like figure out statistics for a bunch of peasants that the PCs aren't even going to fight. You know, give them a couple of names, give the GM something to work with, and then make a railroad plot, just a linear, you know, here's how it's going to go A through Z, and then start branching out when you go backwards. Say, I want a branch here. I want these guys to be led off to, you know, another small town, just a red herring, or I want them to get more clues first. So you tell the GM some ideas on, you know, going to the library. If they go to the library, they're going to, you know, you're going to make a skill roll and they're going to find such and such. Now, one thing to remember about these things is we call it the secret door rule. And when D&D was first conceived, you had these dungeons where, you know, Gary Gygax was writing him as he went along, and he would put a secret door in there when he didn't want people to find out too much. But if they never found the secret door, they couldn't move on. So the same thing's true in Warhammer scenarios, which are way better than D&D scenarios, in that you can't leave out crucial clues. If you have crucial clues, you have to put them both in your scenario synopsis, and you have to put them, bold them in the text. The PCs must find out these things. You know, GMs are smart enough to figure out ways to make sure that PCs learn these things if it's, if it's necessary to get, to the end of a scenario. And then lastly is when you write your NPCs, try and focus on just a few and then have a couple of just background characters. A lot of people write scenarios and they say, well, if the PCs go talk to peasants, this is what they're going to hear. I always prefer, this isn't required, but I always preferred if it was like, well, if the PCs go talk to peasants, they run into Billy Bob and Jim Bob and Heinz. And these three guys are kind of the know-it-alls and the gossipy people of the community, and this is what they know. That gives the GM some names to go with. And obviously wouldn't use those names in a Germanic setting, but that just helps the GM. And it also helps you focus on your writing stuff. You can, you're imagining personalities for these three guys. That just gives some thickness to your scenario without having to add, 2 pounds of text on top of it. So that's where we start.
Layla, you have slanted eyes as if you're
I guess on a very practical level, how would you start? Would you lay out just the general plot first and then fill it in with NPCs, or are you going linearly, like scene by scene? Is there any sort of recommendation that you have?
That depends on a writer's personality. I tend to be a global scope person, so I usually come up with like the big scheme of things, and then I work it backwards. So say, for example, a troll knocks over a bunch of trees and dams up a river, which ticks off a town, and then, some goblins attack, and just kind of all these things, and I usually put them back together. Other people tend to be more linear, and they think in an organized fashion, and they can go step by step and just be like, oh, here's how it's going to work at 1, 2, and 3. But a lot of it's, you're sliding, as with any writing project, you're in that field, you're sliding paragraphs around and just working it into a logical fashion. The one thing to remember at the end of your writing project, though, is very important. You go back and you rewrite your scenario synopsis for how the game actually plays. I've seen a lot of scenarios over the years where people, they don't do that, and they forget to rewrite their synopsis, and the synopsis doesn't really even match what you're writing the scenario, and then the GM gets all confused. So how does it feel?
We should also comment on how things should all be proofread multiple times. Having had read a few of the fan-made supplements for a variety of Warhammer topics recently, it's amazing how little proofreading goes into a few of these. Even Fantasy Flight stuff misses a lot, but fan-made stuff more so.
Well, editing is important, kids.
My experience on this has been, from doing projects and then being on the receiving end, a lot of people are afraid to give criticism and be honest with their friends. And so as a writer, you just got to say, give me the brutal truth here, nitpick everything. And then,
grammar is grammar.
Right.
I feel like people need to accept that fact. Sometimes your sentence just doesn't make sense. Please put in a comma.
Correct.
Or something.
Yeah, and as an author, we gotta shut our mouths. We want to defend every little thing that we did, and don't defend it. Let your editor tell you all the brutal truths, and make notes on a sheet of paper next to you while you're listening to their brutal truths of things that you would improve. And at the end, you ask them questions about the things that you would rather defend, and you'll end up with a much better product.
So I'm kind of like, I'm inspired by this whole concept, but I'm very wary of trying to approach it. But I'm thinking, like, if I were to try something, I would first be inspired by some element of the Warhammer universe that I'd want to write an adventure on. It would be like, I like dragons, or I like chaos dwarves, or a goofy goblin or something or whatever, and then I'd try and build a story around that.
That seems like a logical starting point for me. Find some element and then try and make some wonky story about it that's slightly comical and makes you slightly insane. Probably get a disease along the way, and then you meet some people. And then you flop it down somewhere in the empire that makes sense.
Well, that's the beauty of it. I mean, when you write something, you want to put those, we call them Warhammerisms. You want to put those things in their names of, you know, not just the Chaos Gods, not just, you know, Skaven, if they exist. You don't just put those things in there. You want to give it content. Like, people know they're playing in a Warhammer world, in a Warhammer scenario, and they're not playing in just something that could have been written for any setting at any time. You know?
But I mean, to that degree, you could very easily write an adventure that didn't have to be Warhammer. It could, you know, like the Raven adventure was not specifically a Warhammer adventure. It was loosely tied to Warhammer, but otherwise just an interesting story that was being told that happened to fit the kind of wonky style, and we were an ogre and a halfling within it, but you know, or there was a one-page cannibal adventure that we did a while ago that was a lot of fun, but that didn't have anything inherently Warhammer in it, but it felt correct.
Right. You got to have there's something in there that gives it the feel, and it's not just naming, like I say, not just naming a creature. And it can't just all be doom and gloom and grim and dark and, you know, puke in the streets and, you know, that type of stuff. There's more to Warhammer than just the grim and dirty. But finding that's the fun part. You know, when you get done, you sit down, you look back at your stuff, and you're like, wow, I really want to, you know, make this feel Warhammer. It's easy to go back. But so many projects, when you write them, I mean, don't feel like people are going to attack you because you didn't have a perfect scenario. There's no such thing. I mean, people will run into your scenario, and it won't even play the way that you expected it to play out, because it's not just the GM running, it's the players, you know, and they're gonna see things completely differently than you would, and that's the beauty of it. That's why it's, you know, that's why it's a role-playing game and not just a, you know, going around in a circle and Monopoly game.
So when writing an adventure, how many encounters or how many acts do you envision, you know, even combat encounters, how do you like to pace those, or how many do you include in an adventure? Is there kind of a rule of thumb?
Yes. In a scenario, if you're playing at a convention, you'd want to have probably 2 to 3 combats at most. And if it's a big combat, you just got to hack and have more role playing. I played a scenario at our last convention here that a guy ran. I did a fantastic job, but I spent 3.5 hours, very short amount of role playing, and about 3 hours playing in a single epic combat, you know, throughout this castle manor. And part of what took so long was the fact that we had 3 newbies at the table, and it's hard to sit there and not want to tell them, you know, you forgot to do a maneuver, or, hey, assist me, or, you know, hey, did you look at your career card? Because there's so many components to this game. I think that's something to think of. But like we say, it's 2 to 3. I usually tell people if you do 3 acts with 3 encounters apiece, and they're everything from, you know, the talking to the peasants encounter to, you know, the travel encounter or the getting hired or, you know, your whatever your motivation is encounter for the player characters. But if you shoot for like 9 to 10 total encounters, you can easily put together a quick scenario that's got managed scope. You can pull it all together, and it's easy to edit, and it'll inspire you to do bigger things. I mean, sometimes you get to the end, and it's like, wow, I got to cut out 10,000 words out of this. That sucks.
So. You keep mentioning like scenes and encounters. I think one of the beauties that they've really kind of hit home with third edition is almost like they manage the game like it's a TV show or a movie, where you have a, you know, a scene 1, 2, and 3, and that makes up your act. Then you've got these acts that make up the whole episode. Do you write your adventures in that way, where you kind of restrict the amount of time or content that is in a scene in order to keep it moving and structured, or do you allow lopsided long scenes and then real short scenes, or how do you manage the pacing?
Yeah, that's one of those things you just kind of figure in your own game. You put it in your head. You just, you know, take 10 seconds and go, well, that encounter is going to take about this long, that one's going to take about this long. But I was really skeptical of the three-act system when they put that out for this game, because I've been a traditional, you know, D&D player for all those years of just, you're either exploring a dungeon or you're just marching linearly through 8 combats. And, you know, when it comes to an investigation scenario and a role-playing scenario like this, you don't really know until you get to the playtest sometimes. I mean, you can tell it. We've had situations where we just tell a GM, it's like, well, it's important to get through this encounter. Don't bore your players to death. There's stuff like, you know, sometimes what we write is not all that exciting. It's just going through the motions on some of those encounters. It's just things that have to be in there. So, yeah, if you need to, you put that in there where it's like, you know, move it along at this point. Wrap it up at the end of this act. Just make sure they learn these three things and move to the next act. It's the next day, whatever. That works really great. But yeah, that act system, pulling it together, that's one of those things that it's just that extra, takes that extra step to think about to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I would think it would be important to keep a variety in mind. I know as a player, I don't like adventures that are just made up of the same thing. Like if it's all battle all the time, I get bored because there's no progression to the storyline. If it's all social all the time, I can handle that a little better if there's like some kind of puzzle solving aspect to it. But if it's just wandering around talking to, NPCs without gaining much, you know, addition to the story, then I get bored. So I would kind of want a little bit of everything, like a little bit of a battle sequence, a little bit of some social puzzle solving. In fact, I think like the social puzzle solving leading to the battle sequence makes the battle sequence more rewarding in some senses. So I don't know. That's kind of how I would gauge it if I were to write one.
Well, that's the beauty of having characters in mind. And Warhammer has got what do you figure, 60-70% of the, you know, the careers are not necessarily combat-oriented careers. They don't even have mm-hmm. weapon skill trained. That's
yeah.
the beauty of this system. We're not trapped in a combat-only world. I mean, we always like to say that, you know, it's kind of like D&D with Call of Cthulhu in the fact that you have all these deep, dark secrets and these things, and there's so many ways to die. I mean, you guys have talked about this in the past. On the past episodes, but I mean, you think you got corruption and mutation and disease, you got curses and, you know, I mean, insanity. And
not to mention being stabbed by a sword.
You can go unconscious at the drop of a hat. You got wound thresholds and critical wounds and permanent wounds. I mean, no other game's got that on this. That's
yeah.
the beauty of it. And, you know, those aren't necessarily things you're going to throw in every adventure, but you know, you can inspire GMs to use those things. Just say, hey, now would be a good time if you want to throw in the threat of corruption or mutation or whatever. That only takes a sentence or two.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to write a whole new rule system, which brings me to rules. When you're putting rules in the game, editing is important. And Lila, you'll know this because, again, you're in the field, and I want to pick your brain a second about what you think of the NPCs and, you know, from a literary style.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're putting in the rules, it's very easy to just make sure you reference the page of the Tome of the Adventure or the GM's guide or whatever, and just have it there. You have to assume that GMs have some of these basics. Now, you can't assume they're going to have all the exotic stuff. They may not have Hero's Call. You may have to do a little side box or something for some of those things. But still paraphrase it. You don't have to give out the whole system. It's just like, you know, do the basics. And just reference current rules whenever possible, and it just makes the GM's job so much easier. And then you can always say, well, if you want expanded stuff, you know, reference Hero's Call or reference the social rules and learn of power. And trusting your GM right there on the rules helps. Lastly on this, I just wanted to say that whenever you write a scenario, always either bold or highlight or something your skill checks. Because when you've got a bunch of GM text underneath your read aloud text or whatever, a lot of times things get lost and GMs are scanning through your information and they just want to know what's important through the scene. What's the clue the PC's got to get? If there's a skill check, if there's some big secret, or if there's some trigger in the thing, like if they step into the room, you know, the whole room explodes if they don't make a successful whatever check. You know, you got to highlight those things for GMs. It makes it easier to run on the fly, and it doesn't take anything, just to bold a couple of words too, and just use that, you know, that standard format that Fantasy Flight put forward for these games too.
Leela, if Fantasy Flight's listening, bold more text.
Yes.
Bold more text, please.
Yep, I agree. Leela, I was going to ask you what you thought of kind of the, how do you like to see NPCs presented in a game? I mean, what feels right to you coming from the literary field?
I mean, the more, for me, I really like NPCs who are willing to interact with you in, I don't know, a very pliable way. Like, for instance, in the Raven adventure, one of the NPCs that Daniel had in, I don't know if you've listened to the adventure or not,
yes.
But yeah, that's right, I think you have, but one of his NPCs in the, I think it was a tavern, but the cook or the owner of the mm-hmm. owner of the establishment, he allowed me to go back in the kitchen because my character was like, well, hey, I want to go check out the kitchen. And
oh,
it was so, yeah, it was so random. And I really didn't think that he was going to let me because maybe that would derail whatever scene he was going to have, you know, in the front of the, inside the actual establishment. But he let me go back there. He went back there with me. He even cooked some stuff with me. And I was thrilled. So, like, as a player, I was thrilled because I was like, hey, I'm getting my own scene. Like, this is really fun. My character's having fun. So I enjoy NPCs that are pliable, that the GM will allow to kind of go off on tangents.
I think roadblock NPCs are where the NPC is exclusively there to give you X information and nothing else is a little tough.
Yeah.
As a player.
Yeah. And from a literary perspective, I mean, that's, you know, the more flexible that NPC is, the more memorable he's going to be because it'll allow you to have better interactions.
Do you, from a, when an NPC is presented to you, somebody who's meant to be part of the story, so, you know, some critical NPC, what level of, you know, visual description versus, you know, how they talk and mannerisms and things like that. How much of that kind of stuff is necessary, or where should somebody writing an adventure put their weight?
I think you should always give your NPCs at least one distinctive characteristic if that NPC is going to stick around and be important. I mean, that's a pretty standard writing rule anyway. Like, you want to give your main character some kind of defining characteristic so that people can, you know, like, recognize them on the spot in scenes.
So what are some examples of how to do that?
Like, maybe they say a certain phrase frequently, or maybe they have a patch or, like, some funny physical characteristic, like a peg leg, or they limp or something. You probably don't want to go overboard with it because then you risk boring your, you know, your audience to death. But something quirky like that sticks out for sure.
Well, you could do the same thing as a GM. If a group is fighting a group of perfectly ordinary goblins that don't even have a leader, if the GM so much says as, there's one towards the back and he's got a red cloak on,
mm-hmm.
guess what the PCs are going to do? They're going to go nut job just trying to get to this guy.
Yeah.
And he just happens to have a red cloak.
Right, it's just not his luck.
Why does everybody keep giving me?
Yeah. And some description about, you know, scene description I think is really important too. I don't know. I mean, obviously, there's a lot to be said for mastery. I think Chris does, Chris Wagner,
mm-hmm.
he GMs for us. He sets the scene incredibly well, and it's pretty subtle. Like, he gives you what you need to know, and it's a little flowery, and you've got, like, this really, like, nice sense of where you are, but it's not overboard, and I'm not sitting there for, like, an hour waiting for him to finish his description. So, you know, moderation, I suppose, is key.
What parts do you feel are the most critical, or where do people most often fall short?
Is this for me?
It's for anybody who thinks they have a good answer.
And how,
I think it's mostly for you.
well, you guys, you think of the number of scenarios that we've run. I've been running RPGs since I was 9. I mean, I'm 40 now, so I have run and played and bought and wasted endless college funds on all scenarios over the years.
My GMing techniques have gotten better since I was 9.
Right.
I remember the first games I tried to run with my dad.
Still.
It was a Star Wars one.
So, yeah, I think the word where a lot of people fall short is just to fill space, they'll have a bandit encounter. Bandit encounters are fine, ambushes and stuff, but they can't just be the heck out of the blue. They got to have something to do with the plot. Because just throwing in a bandit encounter, like, oh, well, I'll have some action here. Just to have some action, the group won't get bored. Guaranteed, if you have to have a bandit encounter so the group won't get bored, your scenario is already boring. So it's like,
I can't stand meaningless combat.
No.
I can't stand, I do not want to do it.
Well, plus, I think it'll throw your players off, too, because I think players are, their mindset is geared to look for clues that all fit together for, like, you know, a finale, right? So if you throw in a bandit encounter and it has nothing to do with anything, you've essentially thrown in a red herring that is now going to
occupy 3 hours of your game.
Exactly, when really it wasn't meant for anything and you've got a whole other set of things you want to get done.
Yeah. Yeah, and then I think where the snares that I've enjoyed the most have given me a good grand central theme. I ran a lot of fan-written scenarios over the past 2 years. I was just taking the old second edition ones and converting them over. I mean, I ran Clive Oldfield's Unfinished Symphony. I ran Samuel Kisco's Dog Eat Dog World. And there's been several others that I've done that, you know, just filling in the blanks on some of that stuff, they're memorable because there's stuff in them that you can remember. And it didn't take a huge 8,000-pound gorilla scenario for me to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so I think one of the biggest problems in writers is they want to write too much. They don't know where to kind of edit out and get down to the basics. And again, trust your GM to fill in, be as creative as they want. You write too much, and a GM does not want to write to read your scenario. If you got a 50-page scenario, I'm sorry, you lost me at page one unless there's a really great synopsis. Oh, one other thing I want to talk about on that, adventure backgrounds. Again, with adventure backgrounds, only deal with what's relevant. I don't need to know the history of the Empire going back, you know, before Sigmar. I don't need that, you know. Make it concise and wrap it up, you know, and then get to whoever your big bad evil guy is and why he became evil and his motivation and stuff and go from there. But 2.5 pages of adventure background, oh, I'm sorry, yawn.
What?
How do you guys feel about that stuff?
I mean, I'm certainly picky about brevity. I mean, I like brief and to the point adventures, or at least background synopsis and all that stuff. I want after the first page, if I'm not into the adventure itself, I'm feeling a little anxious. Or
don't you think that it should, you know, if you're going to present anything in the background, it should be, most of it should have the potential to come out in the scenario somehow.
Right.
Either through your big bad evil guy monologuing, or, you know, they're doing their investigation, or they look at old gravestones.
Or the diary he left behind as you're chasing him.
Right. That type of stuff really fills in, you know, later motivation. And that way you actually get to double up your usage. You actually get to use that giant background that you wrote in a diary form or something.
I find as a GM that often the background content doesn't make its way into the games as much as it should.
It should.
Certainly elements of it, but there's a lot of it that seems to get left in the book, and it's really just there for your own. I feel like I know more of the story than really was what comfortably came out in the game, and sometimes I feel like I sort of force it into a game unnecessarily, particularly when we did like the Power of Thane's adventure. I thought that was a little rough. But any final thoughts that we want to add to writing your own adventures?
Just do it. Write
to start.
Email it to me. Send me your worst piece of crap, you know, written after identical to some movie you watched, and I will help anybody who is interested, you know, turn that sucker into not a masterpiece, but something worthy, you know, of being played. You know, just send it over. There's
Jay, how would you prefer people get in contact with you?
Well, I put my email in that thread. That's okay. The best way to do it.
All right, so we have that. We'll have that link in the show notes.
Yep, and I'm on Fantasy Flight's forums maybe 60, 70 times a day. I'm a bit obsessive about it, I think. But so, yeah, real easy to get a hold of, I think, of all of us on those forums.
What? A gamer obsessive?
What? Well, with that, we'll wrap it up for this episode of the Reckless Dice Podcast. We'll be back in 2 weeks with our next episode. Thank you, Layla. Thank you, Jay.
Sayonara.
Until next time, guys, thanks for listening.